We are now? Okay. Okay, good. Good. So this is billed as a Dhamma talk. I usually prefer Dhamma discussions, so I will talk as much as I have to, but feel free to interrupt. And a lot of it for me is, it's really helpful for me to know where you're coming from. And even simple questions and stuff like that has actually helped me to get, and I can hone in more easily. So feel free to interrupt me, or if you start to doze off, ask me a question, I'll wake us both up. May 19th, 1841. It was a Sunday morning, as you all remember, I'm sure. On that morning, there was a Boston minister by the name of Theodore Parker who delivered a sermon that was called The Transient and the Permanent in Christianity. The usual 3,000 people were in church that morning. Actually, they couldn't meet in the church anymore. They had to rent the Boston Music Hall in order to accommodate the masses. Later, a published version of The Transient and Permanent in Christianity was said to have been read more than any single piece of literature. It was read by more people than had ever read any one single piece of literature, at least in the United States up to that point. So transience and permanence was a hot topic during the transcendental controversy in the middle of the 19th century. This morning, don't worry, I'm not going to talk about the transient and permanent in Christianity, or Buddhism, or any other religious system for that matter. But I would like to explore a lot the transient and the permanent in you and me. I'm not going to explore this from the perspective of doctrines, or theology, or metaphysics, or philosophy, or even rational arguments. I'd like to look at it from, as the Buddha did, from the perspective of phenomenology. Right? Phenomenology looks at our direct experience and doesn't try to put it into a much larger structure. If we can find something that is relatively permanent or stable within our subjective sense of self, that can serve as a wellspring for contentment. So I don't expect you to buy into that right now, but that's the thesis I want to explore and kind of move in that.
Could you say that again? Just maybe accentuating another word a little bit more so.
If we can find something that's relatively permanent and stable, that's lasting, within our subjective sense of self, it turns out that that can be a wellspring for contentment, both for us and for the people around us.
Then to further that, subjectivity, objectivity, if you could then just, I know what the term means, but I want to feel that I'm more grounded in it, because it is this way in which we look at the world in a subjective way or an objective way.
Yes.
It seems this or that, but I want to hear you bless us with your understanding of it, because you
I'm gonna go further than
see,
that.
See, I'm just interrupting you.
That's fine. It just helps me know that I'm on track. Okay. So what I would like to do, she's a plant, you know. what I'd like to do is to offer a guided contemplation in which we'll be looking at our direct experience. And so I'm not going to explain it any further. We'll talk about it later. If you'd like to engage this with me, just either close your eyes or find some place to let your eyes rest, some place that's undistracting. There are many elements that can make up this phenomena that we call self. What I'd like to do is to go through of some of these phenomena and imagine getting rid of anything, any elements that are temporary or are impermanent, like anything that can change over time, of just setting those aside, just setting them aside. It'll be like taking off layers of clothes and setting aside anything that is transient. So, for example, your shoes, your books, your electronic devices, the contents of your cupboards or closets or garage, all the stuff in our life, all of that changes or disappears sooner or later. Our cars, our home, our pets. So imagine setting all that material stuff aside and come back. And still, here we are. So now let's see if we can remove some of the immaterial stuff as well. Emotions come and go. Our thoughts arise and pass. Our personality evolves. So set them all aside. Emotions, thoughts, personality, set them all aside. Memories, you know, they form and morph and drift away. Relationships change inevitably. Some childhood friends are long gone. Some newer friends haven't arrived yet. So imagine all your friends, all your relatives, all of them gone. We're putting them someplace safe. You can pick them all up later. But for now, we're just setting them aside. And when we set them aside, yet here we are. There are many skills that we've acquired in our lifetime, from walking to driving to playing the piano, meditating, cooking, using a hammer. Imagine all the skills that we've acquired are gone. Aspirations and dreams come and go. Fears arise and pass. Even our values and principles can shift over time. Imagine them all gone. And still, here we are. If we could remove everything that is transient, would there be anything left? Would there be anything left? What seems to remain is that which has been observing all these things come and go for all these years throughout our life. Body sensations change. How you feel right now is not exactly how you felt 5 minutes ago or 5 years ago or when you were 5 years old. But it feels like what is watching all this is the same today as it was many years ago. And we actually have a name for what remains. We use it all the time. We call this me. It is the eye that has observed all the stuff, all the feelings, all the memories, all the relationships, all of life arising and passing away. Yet this observer feels unchanged. And don't worry about the philosophical arguments about the existence or non-existence of self, anatta. Just see if there is a subjective phenomena of a sense of self that is here and now, observing the transience of our life. It was here a few minutes ago, it was here a few years ago. This unchanging sense of me or I that observes is simple awareness. Simple awareness. If we strip out of awareness all its content, all its processes, all its qualities, we're left with awareness itself, aware of awareness. So I invite you to notice what this simple awareness is like. What are the qualities of this unchanging me-ness? Just make note of those qualities, because we'll want to talk about them in a little bit. Just notice what they feel like. And then when you're ready, you can open your eyes and come back into this room, if you'd like. Comments. What did you notice?
So my subjective experience of it is when it's the awareness, aware of the awareness, it sort of fades in and fades out, mm-hmm. like a pulsing back and forth. So it makes me, of course, go, well, how permanent is that permanence, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's unconvincing when looked at.
Well, when it pulses in, or when it's fading out, what is it like? What are the qualities of it?
I'll need a little more time.
Okay.
Yeah, got to stare at it a little longer. Yeah.
Nice dodge.
Thank you.
A comment of mine, excuse me. Judy. You can go ahead and unmute yourself.
My experience just now was of that awareness was just a deep compassion, and I'm a little overwhelmed right now. just a quality. I was like, oh, I've never thought about what the qualities of it were. And so when I asked myself, yeah, I just felt this like really deep compassion and love. just a little bit different, but an allowing, just like allowing of all of these things. Yeah.
Lovely, lovely, lovely. Yes.
What seemed to be attention, and then I'd want to talk a little bit about the difference between, or if they are, they run side by side, attention and awareness. So I had to open so I could really be present.
Okay.
To exactly what you were saying, and then you said something at the end, and I didn't get it because I was looking at the trees over there, and you said something that was like, this is where we're going, this is really important, and then I felt a little anxious or sad that I missed that. My awareness was not, and so that was curious.
Yeah, and anybody who's ever meditated knows exactly what you're talking about. The mind wanders. And part of what happens too is that as you relax more deeply into that, one of the first things to go is, on a deep level, is the perception itself. Because perception has this quality of putting language, it's slightly conceptual, it puts on it. And as that relaxes, that fades. And there's still awareness that's left. But if you try to say, well, this awareness of this, then you can feel it goes, starts to tighten up again. So when you're done, we need somebody on the far side of the room to raise their hand next.
One of the biggest things I noticed in that exercise was the gripping. The gripping, the
yeah.
reaction of, okay, all your things, let those go. The first thing my mind went to was emotions, though, before you even said the material things. I was like, okay, what are the things that are transient? Okay, emotions, because I was upset yesterday and I'm not upset today. Okay, I know that. But then you mentioned the garage. Well, I did clean out my garage the other day, so I can let that go. The emotions, okay, I can let that go, because that's healthy. Skills, oh, I didn't want to let that go.
Yeah.
I felt a little sad.
Yeah, that's so our identity can get very much involved in the kind of skills and talents and things that we've cultivated. And, one thing we know for sure is we will lose all of those. We will lose them all. So it can be lovely to, well, it can be also scare the bejesus out of us, to look at what it would be like to have some of those core identities gone. And what's left behind at that point? Yes.
I had an interesting experience. For some reason, near the end, you're getting us to this awareness, and what...
Can you hold the microphone?
Oh, sorry. What popped into my mind was a memory when I was young. I used to go into the woods by myself all the time. Nobody would ever have dreamed of doing that, but I used to do it all the time, and would be out there for hours and hours, and that's what popped into my mind, just being a kid, and I can remember it very vividly, just walking in the woods across a stream, and I thought, what is this? Why? why is this coming up in this moment? It was just kind of fascinating, and a part of me didn't want to let it go, but I thought, where is this coming from?
And as the practice goes deeper, there's a lot of that stuff that happens that just like shows up. And our first thought is to try to put it into a structure. And if the mind is really relaxed, there is this place where those images can come through just almost tactoscopically, just like thousands of them, just flow right through. And you can see how what the mind does is very often will just grab hold of something, trying to give us some stability. But the peace and the contentment come out of being able to make peace with how all this stuff is transient. Let's take one more, and then I want to throw some thoughts in.
So my mother died a couple of years ago, and she spent the last 6 years of her life partially paralyzed in bed. And everything you discuss happened. She was just living. She was just breathing. She was just eating. She had the use of two fingers on one hand because it was gnarled with arthritis, and the skills of knitting and all of these activities, it all leaves you. And my sense of time was, God, this is so humbling.
Yeah.
This is the practice, because you do lose everything. And you see it right happening in front of you.
Yeah.
You know, everything. So deep bows.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for that.
Just a comment.
Sure.
Just the one thought I had was that the only thing that's permanent is impermanence.
Yeah, it's sort of a play on words.
Yeah.
Right. There's just the flow, and the banks of the river are in flow. They may flow a little bit more slowly than the rest of the water, and everything is just coming together and coming apart all the time. And we can get that intellectually and to feel that in our gut. Sometimes I end up feeling like I was just suspended in intergalactic space, you know, and there was just nothing there. Let me throw a few more thoughts in this. As was mentioned before, I'm an ordained Unitarian Universalist minister, and my last gig was at, well, Unitarian Universalism has 10 or 11 syllables in it, and so we usually refer to ourselves as just UU. And I was the senior minister at the UU Society of Sacramento up until about 10 years ago. Most UUs are liberal progressives, you know, out on that end of the spectrum, who are more likely to identify as atheist or agnostic or Buddhist than they're likely to identify as Christian, although we have a whole wide variety of people. In fact, UUs tend to put more emphasis on direct engagement with the world around us rather than promoting religious ideas or philosophies, etc. For example, Planned Parenthood of Sacramento was actually started in my congregation about 50 or 60 years ago. They were just getting on with it. And I find UUs to be really good-hearted and slightly over-educated. And, you know, it strikes me, Sacramento Buddhist Meditation Group, you know, has more than 10 syllables in it, and I think the demographic profile of the people here are probably quite similar to a UU congregation. I think UUs tend to lean a little bit more into direct action, and Buddhist Sanghas tend to lean a little bit more into cultivating contentment. But we all value all of it, all value inner practice and as well as outward deeds. Whatever our leanings, if we want lasting contentment, then we have to look at what happens to us as we engage the world around us and pay attention to what happens inside us. Otherwise, our contentment is going to crash and burn, you know, like the young Buddha to be, Siddhartha Gautama's, you know, inner contentment crashed when he was confronted with sickness, old age, and death. Right? So if we truly aspire to be a presence for healing in the world, if that's part of what we value, it's really helpful to sense what's going on out there so we can actually feel others' pain and get some sense whether there's something useful we can do. And at the same time that we're doing that, we have to be reaching really, really deeply inside to see if we can find some source of contentment deep inside us, because the serenity is not found in concepts, our deductions, our political slogans, our philosophical discourse, or rational arguments. The only place it's found is right here underneath my microphone. Right here in our hearts. Right here in our hearts. And since most of us are slightly overeducated, it really helps to realize that there's a lot of wisdom that does not come through the intellect. It just comes directly. My favorite quote on this was actually from Albert Einstein. He said, "I did not discover some of the fundamental laws of the universe through the powers of the rational mind." I think his genius was twofold. One was that capacity to directly intuit. And the second, he also had this very different kind of genius, was to figure out how to translate some of that into mathematical formulas that eventually could be tested. But he clearly valued, you know, the direct intuition even more. And there are some things that we can only know directly, period. Does that seem likely? For example, how would you answer this question? Do you exist? It's not a trick question, right? Do you exist? Are you present?
I would want to ask, do you exist or do you exist?
Thank you. Thank you. I think, do you exist or do... I'm thinking about emphasis here. Do you exist or do you exist? The concrete self or the continuous perception, that is a matter of what you want to find out of that question in a way.
Yes, yes. My hope is, though, that all of you would answer that question in the affirmative, right? And then my follow-up question is one of, well, how do you know that? Right? It's not a matter of rational deduction. It's not a matter of figuring something out. It's just something you know just by being present, by living in the present. It comes back to the question here of how do you know what the five senses are? A lot of people would argue that there are a whole bunch of them that don't get mentioned. How do we know anything? How do we know anything? I think I want to put a pin in that and hold it for just a moment, because we can really go down. How do you know who is doing the knowing? And again, in the deepest meditation, all that disappears. It all disappears, all of it. The simple direct knowing, in one sense, is just obvious, but in one sense, it's hard to put your finger on. So I would say that to be a presence for healing in the world, we need a lot of just kind of ordinary awareness of what's going on around us so that we can engage in ways that are helpful. And there's a lot we can do to help. Direct service, working with groups like Loaves and Fishes, Weave. I assume Sacramento Buddhist Meditation probably has some direct engagement projects going on. There can be lots of stuff we can do that way. And we can also do lots of really informal things. I was out walking along the bicycle trail along the American River, and there's a place up there near Arden Way where there's a bridge over the river. There are a lot of Afghani who have migrated up into that area, and you see a lot of them out there in the parks, particularly when it's warm. So I was walking across the bridge, and there was this young family of four. There were two kids. They looked to be about, you know, maybe 6 and 9, and then mom and a dad. And dad was over there with his cell phone camera, getting his family to stand on the other side of the bridge so he could get a picture of them with the river in the background. And as I walk up to them, they were speaking some Mideastern dialect that I didn't know what it was. I couldn't understand what they're saying. But as I walked up to him, he was handing his wife the camera and motioning her to come over and take a picture of him with the kids. So I walked up, and with gestures and stuff, I conveyed that I would be glad to take a picture of all four of them. And at first, they were a little kind of taken back and wary of it, and then they realized what I was saying, and they smiled, and they stood there, and I took a couple pictures, and they just beamed. And as I walked on off the bridge, I think I felt more delighted than all of them together. Right. So simple acts of kindness can shift our presence. They can shift the way we perceive ourselves and the world around us. And I think those are very, very important. But again, for the deepest healings, the actions, you know, those surface actions by themselves are not enough, unless our actions are infused with contentment. Unless our actions are infused with contentment. And I don't mean arguing or promoting. I mean this. We know it so deeply that it just glows through us and touches those around us. And we can't communicate what we don't feel. So, let me frame the problem this way. How do we find and feel contentment when we are surrounded by wars, dysfunctional Congress, rising global temperatures, income inequality, and all the rest, polarization, artificial intelligence roaring down the mountain like a freight train, all of that stuff. How do we find contentment as we engage a world of chaos? Let me suggest a metaphor, and then we can see how it, you can see how it might apply to your life or not. Imagine a junior high classroom. Yeah, you're laughing already. So the first bell has rung, all the kids are there, the teacher's running a little bit late, and so they're playing the boom boxes and throwing airplanes and punching each other's arms and cracking jokes, and the room just crackles with adolescent energy. Right? And meanwhile, off in the corner there in the back by the back window, there's a young woman, an adolescent, who is quietly writing poetry. And we wouldn't even know she was in the room because of all the commotion. So how do we find that quiet poet? Well, the first strategy people go for is to try to get everybody to sit still and shut up and put their feet on the ground and be quiet so that we can just feel her. And that's a good argument for contemplative practices and meditation practices. But an even more skillful way to do that is to not waste energy or stir up more commotion by scolding people to sit down and shut up, but is to simply turn your awareness inside and see if you can feel any tension in there. You can even do it right now as we're talking. You just let your awareness go inside and see if there's any tension. And if there is, you can invite it to soften, invite it to relax. And the secret is that as you relax more, you see that the awareness itself is enough to allow the tension to soften. So, what does all this have to do with Buddhism? Do you see the direct connection? So most scholars and students of Buddhism would say that the core of the Buddha's teachings are in the Four Noble Truths, the Four Ennobling Truths, to use Stephen Batchelor's term for it. The first is that there is suffering, and there are verbs that go with it. These verbs get lost, but they're right there in the text. The Buddha said, suffering is to be understood. To understand something, you can't turn away from it and run away or shove it under. So the first thing you have to do is to turn towards it, towards the tension, towards our own suffering, so we can understand more how it operates. And the second ennobling truth says that the core, the root, the seed of our stress is the Pali term, the language of the suttas, that are first recorded in Pali, or the extant ones anyway, is tanha, which just means tension. And the verb that goes with that is very dramatic. The Buddha said, tanha is to be abandoned. So you turn towards the suffering so you can understand it, and when you can see the tension in there, how do you abandon tension? You just relax. Abandon it, walk away from it, don't fuss around with it. You just soften. But there's actually even a more direct way to do this. Imagine coming into that classroom early in the morning. Nobody's there except the young poet is there. And so we go and sit and talk with her a little bit. Maybe do a little bit of her own writing as she composes. And as we do that, the other kids start coming in the room. And they bring in their boom boxes and they're messing around, and pretty soon the whole cacophony is back again. But then, even in the midst of all that commotion, you can still sense that quiet pod, because we know what she feels like, and we know what tranquility feels like inside us. Can you feel it right now? Yeah. So in that guided contemplation that we did earlier, we just tried stripping away all the transient elements. Not worrying about the philosophical thing about the existence or non-existence of self. That will take care of itself. When we strip everything away in the phenomena of self, we're left with pure awareness. And it's pure not in the sense of being pristine, but it's without content. And actually without qualities. And without processes. So right now, as you sit here, there are probably a certain amount of emotions and feelings and thoughts going through your mind. You've been listening to my words and we've been talking some. That's probably maybe stirred some things inside you, and that stuff gets triggered, and there are images of trees and memories of earlier in the day and all kinds of stuff. So we have this whole mass of stuff that just floats around in there. And without trying to stop any of that, can you feel back behind all that? Or maybe beneath it, it's just a metaphor, but back behind all that, can you feel a quiet? There's a stillness. Right? It's always there. It's always there. It feels a little bit like stepping back. Does that quiet feel new? Or does it feel ancient? Does it feel like something that you've always known and keep forgetting? It is always there. It is always there. And of course, part of the problem is that it's quiet. It doesn't jump up and down and yell and scream to get our attention. It's like the quiet poet just sitting there in the back, patiently waiting, no agenda other than just being. Yes?
I taught school for 50 years, and when I started, I don't know how to keep the kids in their seat. They were 8, 9, and 10-year-olds. I had all of them in one class. I made a community, and it took me several years. And this is what I did. They got it.
Yes. You could feel the quiet settle in the room here, just even as you did that.
Let me just describe that for the folks on Zoom. So I think you were just sitting quietly and then making eye contact with folks around you. Was that? Yes. Is that an accurate description? Okay.
Exactly. But there was no movement other than my eyes and no sound coming from me.
Yeah. I think we're just trying to get it for the people who are zooming in.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Just a reminder, the mic's not for the folks in the room. It's more for folks. We have, I think, like 25 folks on Zoom that can only hear if you're talking to the mic. So, thank you. Okay, cool. Angela said it's also for folks in the back of the room because it's hard to hear.
So let me just underline all this, that this quiet that is back there and comes and goes from our awareness, but seems like it's been there forever, is very real. It's very real. Whatever it is that we are, it's embedded in us. It's there. And again, contemplative practices and meditation, etc., can strengthen our connection to that. But they do not create it. They do not create it. It's always there. The practice is not about attainment. Drives me crazy when people talk about attainment. It's all about attunement. It's all about tuning into what's there. Okay, that's enough for me.
So I've been contemplating this sort of phenomenology, these emotions that just arise without the attachments behind that. And I'm thinking about something like death. Mm-hmm. Death makes us sad. I think that's not like a contentious thing to
death
say.
Death makes us what?
Sad.
Sad.
I think that's a very widespread thing, right? In our pursuit.
Blake wrote a poem that said something like, my grandmother sang hallelujahs on her deathbed.
Well, in our pursuit of contentment, are we wishing to achieve a state where we do not feel, for example, sadness in the face of death? Or are we seeking to achieve a state of contentness coexisting with our sadness?
I would go beyond all of that. That it's not a matter of attaining anything. It really is a matter of attuning to see and feel what is there already. I think the doctrine of original sin did a number, in our culture thousands of years ago, and it's really kind of stuck, even if we don't believe that particular theology, of thinking that there's something that's fundamentally broken, and so we've got to create something else. And it kind of looks like that when you see somebody that just is an embodiment of peace. It's like, wow, how did they get that? And what they did on a very deep level is just relaxing into what's already there. And what happens if there's tension in the system, as you relax, it's not instantaneous. And there's some things that may need to unwind a little bit. And so there's something that's very helpful in meditation is actually learning to recognize the difference between when you're tightening up and making something worse and when something is just unwinding. But it unwinds at an organic pace, not at the speed of light. Because literally, there's stuff that gets thrown in the bloodstream and stuff that needs to be metabolized out. But recognizing as we are moving in the right direction and actually worrying less about the end state.
I was just going to say, I like to think of it as a gentle hold. I was just going to say, I like to think of it as a gentle holding. We typically want to have aversion towards anything that we perceive as negative, sadness, anger, fear, those sorts of things. We love the other ones, happiness. We tend to run towards those, but I think of it as if you're not holding suffering, but being present with it. Mm-hmm. And that's when the natural unfolding happens, because right. It has to release organically. So in order for you to do that, you can't have any aversion to it or moving towards it. You just have to be with it. And that is incredibly difficult, as we all know, but I think it certainly is, can be done.
Yes, and I also think there's something humbling about just acknowledging that we live in a body that evolves through the laws of evolution. And those laws, all they care about is what it takes to pass our genes successfully on to the next generation. And that's not always peace and well-being or even truth. It's quite natural that we would have physiological responses to various things. And there is a real difference between trying to get a hold of those and figure it out and work with them and manage them and stuff like that and say, oh, of course. And you just soften and open into them and let them kind of unwind on their own. Sort of like looking around the classroom, just, here we are. Or like Lila does with me, here, I'm here, we're here together, life is good.
Online.
Oh, okay.
Hello, this is Leslie. And thank you for coming to teach us today. So my question is this, my emotional state is pretty much always anxiety and fight or flight. And so I'm very interested in this topic of how one approaches that kind of feeling. And it is not the case that I just focus, because I've been doing it as you've talked, inviting softening and relaxing. It may work if I did it for like 20 minutes, but it will never work in the immediate moment. I heard you say what I thought was two different things. Most of the time, I've heard you say you just need to be with it, which is unpleasant. But just stay with it and be with it. But on one occasion, you quoted somebody, I forget who, as saying that you should abandon it. My anxiety, it gets anxious about hearing that it should be abandoned. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little more about that.
It's a great question, and it's how do we do this dance? And just kind of quickly, I think the most important part of it is that anything that comes up inside us has some wisdom about it. It may have a whole lot of other stuff too. It may have a whole lot of stuff that's the opposite of wisdom, that this just craziness. For example, with the anxiety is actually trying to protect you to keep you from getting hurt. And with a lot of my own anxiety over the years, I've had to look at it and say, you know, feel the anxiety, and, you know, I had an alcoholic father, and, you know, it wasn't a bad childhood, but, you know, we all survived childhood one way or another. I'll have a little bit of PTSD. To be able to just, you know, look at that and realizing that in some sense what I was having is what I would call body flashbacks. There's some deep feelings inside to get triggered. And so one of the questions that I would ask myself is there danger? You know, is there danger right now? And if I'm getting uptight because I can't remember if I turned the stove off, then I should just get up and go make sure the stove's turned off. But oftentimes look at anxiety about things that are not actually current in the moment, at which point I would say, thanks, you know, I think we got this one covered now. Or sometimes there's something that's coming up that may be a threat and dangerous, but it's not happening right now, and so it's seeing that distinction. Okay, I have to figure that one out, but here we are, it's okay at the moment. My wife grew up as a Quaker, for a couple years I visited that friend's meeting, and there was an elder there who used to describe meditation as putting a basket of puppies to sleep. So they'd all quiet down, and one would stick its head up, so you scratch it behind the ears and pat it, and it goes, and another one sticks its head up and scratch it behind the ears. And so when these anxieties and things, you know, pop up, you gotta love them. You know, and to love them, you really have to see in a way that's not faking anything, but to see what the wisdom was in them, and whether it's still applicable or not, and if there's something we need to do, and if not, then we just reassure it. You know, we soothe ourselves. And when we have a lot of stuff, it can take a while, you know, to get the whole litter of puppies to sleep. But what else are you going to do? What else are you going to do? So I just want to get a logistics thing here. We're about 10 or 15 minutes till noon. Okay, I think that we had a hand in the back there.
Thank you. This might be taking kind of a left turn off what you've been talking about, but it's something that is of concern to me. And has
please,
been
please.
Long time,
yeah, please.
Which is the notion of enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
Enlightenment seems to me to be a distraction from the practice. And the way you've been talking right now helps me feel that that's really true, because you haven't mentioned it at all. But you're not the only teacher out there. And there are teachers who've talked here who've taught much like you have. And so I've gone back and read their books, and they're all about enlightenment. It's very confusing. I don't quite know what to make of it, but right now it's right. And I've been practicing for a long time, so I've been listening to this stuff for a long time. I find it very distracting and very difficult to get through because it seems to be such a goal for
yes.
so much of the practice.
So much attainment. It drives us crazy. The Buddha, you know, I think he was teaching dependent origination or something like that, and then he paused and he turned to, you know, the people around him and said, you know, if you make a thing out of this and start striving for it, it's just going to bring you grief. Enlightenment, what I see, you know, the core of that is actually lightening up. It's just lightening up. And find ways, and you can test it, you know, to see if lightening up makes things a little better. The only thing that's important, we don't know what the end point is. I don't. I know some people's words about it. But just if you have a sense that you're actually moving in the right direction, then what comes next is really unimportant. And I think organic paths, you know, will wind and curve just like a landscape winds and curves. So it's not like a straight line superhighway that cuts, you know, through the mountain, et cetera. Ease, kindness, well-being, things that are really simple. I think enlightenment is a lot more ordinary and a lot closer and a hell of a lot simpler than most people would make out. It is not a big deal. It's not a big deal. As far as I can tell, it's pretty cool, but it's not a big deal. Things get simpler and easier and just obvious. And if it feels like it gets complicated, then it doesn't make any difference whether what those people saying is right or not. At least how you're receiving it is not helpful. So we don't have to pass judgment on them. We can just know it's not helpful. And so what the Buddha said, what you're referring to there, was that suffering is to be understood. And that the core element, it was like an Aikido move. The only thing he did anything different with was where there's the tension of allow that to relax as you're watching the suffering and everything else going on. And you can feel as that happens, you feel that your heart and your system opens up more.
Okay. Just going to make a kind of a quick question, hopefully quick question. Would it be safe to say that enlightenment is kind of coming upon what you need to do for liberation? Where you go, that's what it is I need to do. And it's more of like realizing all the stuff you need to let go of. Would that be safe to say?
Yeah, I think the problem is that we make a noun out of it. It's really a process. English has a higher percentage of nouns than just about any other language. Pali, the language the Buddha spoke, is the opposite. So a lot of the stuff that you see translated as nouns are really gerunds. You know, they're really movement and action. So it's really, you want to look for the movement. Thank you, that was a great observation.
I have a question.
Oh, here we go, we got one.
I'm so sorry, I know I've spoken a lot, but I just,
No, you're not
this
sorry.
This feels really kind of imperative. When I walked in and I saw my old, sweet, kind teacher for a really long time, and I can't tell you how important he is and how important he was for me and his wife. And I love that we've come in and we're invited to participate. That's not always common, if you know. We sit and we have question and answer. And this is a form where I hope it moves forward. So many important things are said with all of us. It's really, and having this topic, I thought you were getting to the really big one, and you were, when you said, we live in this state of affairs. It's just so hard. How do we find our sense of calm and ease and stillness, quiet, calm? But still, I need to talk about this subject. We all do, because it's, how do we deal with it and find that? But So
part of the issue with that is to not, it's like enlightenment, it's not looking for...
I know that.
It's like not looking for an answer,
yeah,
but looking at... I'm going to cut you off for a bit of time. We have another question over here.
Oh.
But I have a story.
Okay.
Of one of my students who has more equanimity than I've ever seen in anybody. And he had a small business, and he looked at his account online, and there was $100,000 that was missing. And he kind of, you know, the obvious story is that he figured it all out and he got the money back. But I was really... intrigued that he was so unruffled during all of this. Mm. And so I was really picking at him, saying, so what did you do? What did you do? And he said, well, when I saw that the money was gone, there's a chance I might not ever get it back, and it was just gone. And so, you know, being upset didn't... There was no point to that. And it wasn't that he pushed it aside, it just didn't stir him. But if I could get it back, what would be the next thing for me to do? Which he thought, well, that was to call the bank. So that's what he did. And then he got something from the bank, and that led to the next step, and that next step, and the next step, and then the money came back. And I think about, I'm working with Harvard University on a couple projects about meditation. I realize that his practice of just the next step, doesn't sound at all like meditation, right? But I think it'll go to the same place. So there's just lots and lots of ways of coming at this.
Yeah, I was going to ask a question. How I've always thought of enlightenment, which may be absolutely incorrect, I've always thought of it as, how can you attain something you already are? There's no way, I mean, you already have it, so there is no attainment. You just need to let all of the difficulty is letting all of the other stuff that's covered it up unfold, as you say, organically. And to me, the only way to do that is through the path, which is everyday life and sitting in meditation and all of it. So that's kind of how I have conceptualized it, so that I'm not continually thinking about it as a grasping toward.
Right, right.
It's already present.
Yeah.
That's just how I've come to make peace with that whole thought process. And I don't know if that's right or not, but that's what I've come to.
Yeah, and the, sort of the question of that is sort of, you know, what's next, you know, given this moment?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll be time for maybe one more question. There's one more online or in the room.
If you walk out here in 10 minutes, you think, oh, I wish I'd asked this. This is your chance.
I don't know. Okay. I haven't organized it. But I probably will think, why didn't I talk to him about it? Okay. So when you were talking about, you know, direct experience versus intellectualizing and kind of knowledge-based rational brain stuff, and then
one of the topics that came up was kind of like helping people, and that it's easier than sometimes we make it out to be, and maybe something as simple as taking a photo for our family. And before the example, you know, I think you mentioned, like, there's a lot of stuff going on in the world and all this stuff, and I personally worked in international development for 15 years, and I think I struggle with, you know, that example of, you know, if we're using direct experience and we're trying to do good or trying to do something, you know, and then we want it after just feel good, there's so much out there that is well-intentioned but doesn't actually end up having the benefited effect on, you know. And so I think there's kind of a danger sometimes of like maybe doing what feels good by direct experience,
right,
rather than some of the intellectual,
right,
you know, kind of complicated, like.
And that's why I think the personal practice is so important, because that's how you cut through that. Because it's inevitable. It's inevitable. I mean, we can't survive without, you know, some structures that are going on. And so, and that's why I think Buddhism puts so much emphasis on intentions, and see what your intentions are, and looking deeply, and then those will sort themselves out. And we'll screw up. You know, we do it all the time. You know, anybody here ever raised a child? You know, it's like, you know, it's quite humbling. And I think, just to come back to the, you know, the same theme as before, of, you know, what we're doing in the moment and where it seems to go, and then being open to not even hanging on to I can't bring the story back, but there are in many stories of, you know, people building something and then at the last minute realize it was wrong, they just tear apart and go on. And sometimes we need to do that. Let me close with talk about doing good in the world. This is a passage that some of you have probably have some familiarity with. It comes from Nelson Mandela's inaugural address. And he uses a God language in there, but work with it. You'll know what he means. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that frightens us most. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small doesn't serve the world. There's nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It's not just in some of us, it's in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. May it be so. May it be so. Thank you so much for coming and for sharing your thoughts and feelings and energy with us. It's been a delight. Namaste.
Namaste.